Defense officials say hundreds of military policemen from the United States and other countries will be arriving soon in Iraq to assist in maintaining law and order there. Some critics are wondering why the police weren't sent in earlier. Studies of past U.S. interventions have concluded that the collapse of a government often is followed by immediately by a period of anarchy. NPR's Tom Jeltam reports on a lesson not learned.
U.S. military forces invade a country to topple a dictator. Resistance to the invasion fades, the regime falls, and then looting and lawlessness. Baghdad earlier this month, but in December 1989, it was Panama City, described by freelance reporter David Adams, just 2 days after U.S. troops overthrew Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega.
The shop fronts down the main streets in the commercial areas have been smashed in. Some of them even have been set alight and burned. And people just pouring in and out of the shops, carrying whatever they can, and some of them even loading it into the back of pickup trucks, cars driving around with furniture strapped to the roofs.
Most of the damage done in Panama as a result of the U.S. military operation there came after the actual invasion, during days of disorder that followed the destruction of the Panamanian defense forces. Richard Schultz was hired by the Pentagon to identify lessons that could be learned from the Panama operation. The big mistake, he says, not being prepared for a total collapse of law and order.
There was nothing in the operational plan for the post-conflict period that indicated that that could be a problem. So they really didn't expect that to occur, and when it did, it took them by surprise.
The parallels with Iraq are obvious. Schultz, a professor at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, reported that in Panama, the U.S. military assumed the local police forces would not entirely collapse and could be successfully reassembled in short order. The Iraq post-war plan included similar assumptions. But Schultz says the Panama planners underestimated how challenging it would be to reconstitute a local police force that would uphold the rule of law and serve a democratic government.
Those are not easy things, and Panama demonstrated without a doubt that we didn't have a good idea about that going in.
The Panama operation also showed that regular U.S. military forces are not well prepared to take on policing roles. That point was reinforced in 1993 when U.S. soldiers got tied down in bloody street fighting in Somalia. A year later in Haiti, it seemed a lesson had been learned. While the 82nd Airborne was preparing to invade, a separate international police force stood by in Puerto Rico, ready to deploy immediately to restore law and order. But a year later in Bosnia, the policing lesson was apparently unlearned again. U.S. soldiers did not intervene when Serbs around Sarajevo burned properties to the ground rather than turn them over to the Bosnian government under the terms of a peace treaty. Robert Perito, who designed the police portion of the Haiti operation, now directs the Rule of Law Project at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Last fall, Perito prepared a detailed plan for how police duties should be handled in the aftermath of an Iraq war. His main recommendation, do not leave the work to the regular military.
Soldiers generally do not want to perform police functions. They're not trained to do it, they're not equipped to do it, and they have other responsibilities. That's why many of us recommended from the start that civilian security forces be included along with the intervention force so that there would be trained personnel that would be equipped to go in and take care of these functions. And if not civilians, at least military police.
The Council on Foreign Relations and the Atlantic Council made similar recommendations. The Institute of Peace proposal called for a total of 2,000 police personnel organized in 17 company-sized units to go into Iraq immediately behind the intervention force. Perito and others briefed staff at the White House, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and the Defense Policy Board, a Pentagon advisory group. But none of the proposals seemed to get much attention.
As we went into the conflict, it was clear that there were no forces being recruited and they weren't part of the operation. And so, that was evident right from the start. We hoped it wasn't true, but it turned out to be the case.
Pentagon officials explaining the decision to send only regular military forces to Iraq say wartime needs took precedence over post-war requirements. Army Lieutenant General David McKiernan, commander of land forces in the Iraq campaign, reminded reporters this week that his troops had to fight their way into Baghdad.
I can tell you from being here that those lead formations, first of all, were killing bad guys, and secondly, were protecting Iraqi people. And so if some of the facilities became subject to looting by Iraqis. I will tell you that our priority was to fight the enemy and to protect Iraqi people.
The ideal force for restoring law and order in a place like Baghdad would be what's called a constabulary, essentially a national police trained to operate as a semi-military organization. But the United States and Britain do not have such forces, and of the countries that do, including Spain, Italy, and France, none wanted to join the U.S.-led war effort in Iraq. Former Defense Secretary James Schlesinger co-presided over the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on Iraq, which recommended that the Pentagon send a police force alongside the main warfighting force. He says the failure to include that policing component was a defect of an otherwise successful war plan, but he understands why it did not happen.
The United States, which along with Britain was the driving force behind the actions that were taken, did not have the requisite assets in the form of a constabulary. The Army could have set aside some military police, but that did not take place.
Schlesinger is also a member of the Defense Policy Board, chaired by Richard Perle during the lead-up to the Iraq War. Perle was a strong supporter of the administration's war plan, but he agrees the U.S. government needs to improve its post-war policing capability.
I do think it would be very helpful if we had available in Iraq today a trained and dedicated force that is well instructed in how to maintain order in the face of disorder and to deal with the sorts of problems that have arisen in Iraq, not just for this situation, but for other future situations as well.
Pentagon officials say an effort is underway now to recruit an international civilian police force to help in Iraq. At a meeting in London this Sunday, governments with available units are set to consider whether they now can contribute some forces to the Iraq operation. But Robert Perito worries the effort is seriously behind schedule and that time is short. Former Iraqi security and intelligence units, he argues, were in many cases involved in criminal activity under Saddam Hussein and could be more dangerous than ever if they now move underground.
What happened in other places, and I think will happen in Iraq as well, is that these groups will change from being government intelligence and security services into organized criminal enterprises. And because they have coherence, because they have organization, trained personnel, and money, they will emerge very quickly as the dominant forces in the society.
Perito points to Russia, Serbia, and Bosnia to illustrate what can happen when public security needs are neglected in a time of sweeping political change. In all three cases, old regimes were thrown out of power, and the governments that came in were slow to establish and enforce the rule of law. Organized crime is now a powerful force in all three countries, and Perito argues Iraq could turn out the same way if an effective police body is not established there soon. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.